From claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt.
EWTN Radio presents The Miracle Hunter with Michael O'Neill.
Welcome to The Miracle Hunter Radio Show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm The Miracle Hunter. Hey everyone, I'm back. I was gone for a little over a week in South America, looking for miracles in Brazil and Argentina. And I stopped by the Aparecida, the site of the miraculous image of the Virgin of Aparecida. Somewhat of a Lourdes of South America, an absolutely amazing shrine, an old basilica, a new basilica, a giant walkway between the two. It's really an incredible place to see. We got to see the location where the statue was found and attend Mass there, and also learn about this incredible devotion of Our Lady of Aparecida there in Brazil. We also traveled to Argentina, and we filmed for a new Eucharistic Miracles mini-series that will be coming out next July. We filmed the Eucharistic Miracle of Buenos Aires. Of course, that's the miracle that was uncovered and investigated through the impetus of the future Pope Francis, Jorge Bergoglio. Absolutely amazing to interview the local parish priest at the time of the miracle, some witnesses as well. So it was an amazing, amazing trip. And also, Our Lady of Luján and Our Lady of Itati and Our Lady of San Nicolas. Four of the great miracle sites there in San Nicolas. Got to interview the bishop and meet the bishop there at Itati. It was absolutely incredible. Look out for new episodes of Explore with the Miracle Hunter as I go to South America. Those will be airing next year. So we're so excited for that. But it's good to be back in North America. And I've got a great show ahead for you today. And I'd like to thank Father Edward Looney for stepping in last week. He did a nice job stepping in to cover the show last week. So you can tune in to his coverage of the Miracle Hunter last week if you go to the EWTN.com/radio website or go through the app and you can listen to the interviews that he did for the Miracle Hunter show in my stead. And this week, we've got a great show coming up as well. We've heard about various times in Christian history, whether it's the Battle of Warsaw in Poland or the Battle of Lepanto, or there's another one called the Battle of Vienna. And we'll be joined by the president of Catholic Answers. That's Christopher Cech. He's going to be joining us to discuss the incredible miracle of war that happened there and where Christian forces won against all odds. We'll also be speaking with Maria Moreira Johnson about Our Lady of Charity, that feast day, September 8th, of the most famous Cuban Marian devotion, Our Lady of Charity del Cobre. She'll be talking to us about her own background as a Cuban American and also her visits there to that site and talking about her book, Our Lady of Charity, How Cuban Devotion to Mary Helped Me Grow in Faith and Love. So we'll be excited to talk to her later in the show. And next week, on Wednesday, September 13th, They Might Be Saints, my program about men and women from the United States on the path to sainthood, will be looking at Father Michael McGivney. And as always, I like to joke that he's my bet, if I were a betting guy, that he'll be the next American saint. He's a blessed now, but he's got so many Knights of Columbus praying for his intercession. So he's likely, in my opinion, to be the next American saint. But for this episode, I'll be examining the canonization cause of the founder of the Knights of Columbus, Michael McGivney. He was beatified in 2020. I was there with the EWTN crew, and we filmed that. And we also filmed an interview with the miraculous cure of a young boy who received a cure from fetal high drops. And it was truly amazing, with essentially a 0% chance of survival. Through the intercession of Father Michael McGivney, that boy is alive and well. And check out my show, Explore with the Miracle Hunter, which airs every Saturday, including tonight, at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. On tonight's show, I'll be traveling to Pompeii. I'll be taking a trip to the famed ruins of Pompeii, where I'll explore the life's work of Blessed Bartolo Longo, known as the Apostle of the Rosary, and talk about some of those incredible miracles that surrounded him in his life. So check that out, Explore with the Miracle Hunter, Pompeii, tonight at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. And look out for my latest book, Science and the Miraculous, How the Catholic Church Investigates the Supernatural. Many people are interested in how the Church investigates things like Eucharistic miracles, and that book goes through all the ways that the Catholic Church employs science, where possible, to validate miracles that are happening all around the world. It's available from Tan Books, and you can get it at EWTNRC.com. Later in today's show, we're going to be looking at the 365 Days with Mary project. For today's day, we've got Holy Mary, or Santa Maria la Antigua, Holy Mary the Ancient, from Panama City in Panama in the 16th century. The might-be saint of the day is Blessed Jacques Désiré Laval, who lived from 1803 to 1864 in France. And the question of the week: why wasn't St. Christina the Astonishing beatified? We'll see if we can answer that one later in the program today. Let's take a look at the miracle news. We do this every week where we talk about the miracles happening all around the world and those things that relate to miracles. Sometimes we have big miracle stories, perhaps Eucharistic miracles or Marian apparitions or weeping statues, or the canonization of saints and the healing miracles that are used for that. But today we have kind of a human interest story about a miracle rescue. A man and dog was saved after 3 months at sea. He thanks the rescuer. So after drifting at sea for 3 months, Timothy Shattuck and his dog Bella were rescued by a commercial Mexican fishing boat. Timothy Lindsay Shattuck, age 54, from Sydney, Australia. He's an amateur sailor. He was rescued last month by a commercial Mexican fishing boat after drifting into the Pacific Ocean for 3 months with his dog Bella. And photos show an emaciated man, Shattuck, wearing a rosary around his neck and a bright smile on his face as he receives medical attention shortly before arriving in the Mexican port of Manzanillo. His quote is, "I'm just so grateful to be alive." He had drifted 1,200 miles from his last seen spot in his damaged catamaran. And his journey began in April when they set sail from the Mexican port city of La Paz with the goal of reaching French Polynesia, 3,700 miles away. And they were blown off course when a storm damaged their vessel and knocked out their communication system. And the two survived on rainwater, raw fish, and companionship, as Shattuck praised Bella, saying she's amazing and that dog is something else. So absolutely amazing that they were able to survive in those adverse circumstances, and that they were found. And it was said that he was praying the rosary as he was going along. So is that some sort of a miracle? Sounds like something of one, but absolutely amazing. You can check out the Facebook feed of The Miracle Hunter for more information on this fascinating story and any of the other miracle stories that are happening all around the world. Let's take a look at Catholic Pub Trivia. We do this every week where we ask a trivia question and give out a prize to an emailer that gives the right answer. And we give out this image of the faces of Mary. For last week's question, Father Edward Looney, who was guest hosting, interviewed Anna Nuzzo, a musician with a Marian devotion. And so we had a question from last week related to the patron saint of musicians. What early Roman martyr is considered the patron saint of musicians? And that, of course, is Saint Cecilia. She was born in 200 to 230, and she died from 222 to 235. And I guess record keeping wasn't as precise back then, but I've traveled to her shrine in Rome, and she is considered to be the first incorruptible in history. And she became the patroness of music and musicians. It's said that as musicians played at her wedding, Cecilia sang in her heart to the Lord, and musical compositions are dedicated to her and her feast day, November 22nd. With various occasions of concerts and musical festivals in Rome. She's known as Cecilia of Rome. So thanks for writing in with that answer. And the person with the right answer was Juanita Riojas. She'll be receiving the prize, the image of the faces of Mary. And this week, the question is, we're talking today about the Battle of Vienna with Christopher Check from Catholic Answers. And the question is, what was the name of the famous battle on October 7th, 1571, from which we get the Marian invocation, Queen of Victory, and the feast day, Our Lady of the Rosary, on October 2nd, 7th. So we're looking for the name of the battle that led to the Marian title, Queen of Victory, and feast day of Our Lady of the Rosary. If you think you know that answer and want to win the prize, the image of the faces of Mary, send me an email to miraclehunter@ewtn.com, or just go through my website, miraclehunter.com, and you can send me your answer that way. And answers and winners will be posted on the show page on miraclehunter.com. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be talking to Christopher Check, the president of Catholic Answers, about the amazing, miraculous finish to the Battle of Vienna. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. We talk about miracles a lot on this show, and maybe that's all we talk about. And we talk about miracles of different sorts. But there have been, on some rare occasions, big occasions throughout Christian history, we might point to something as being miraculous happening in the context of war. We're all familiar with the Battle of Lepanto, or perhaps the Battle of Warsaw. But there are numerous other cases throughout Christian history where we see the Christian forces coming out on top, perhaps through some divine intervention. We're so grateful to be joined today by the president of Catholic Answers. That's Christopher Check, joining us again to talk about another incredible military happening here. Thank you for being with us today, Christopher.
Michael, thank you for having me back. It's good to be with you.
Now, this is the September anniversary, more or less, of this incredible victory in Vienna in 1683. This happened almost a half century ago, but half a millennium, 500 years ago almost now. But this is worth remembering because this was a significant battle. If you would, for the audience, just paint the picture, what's going on in Europe at the time, especially related to the Ottoman Turks and their chance to strike at this the Christian enemy?
Sure. Well, you mentioned the Battle of Lepanto, which takes place about a century before the events that we're going to talk about today. And that was a major naval victory in which the Holy League, led by Don John of Austria, crushed the Ottoman fleet in what today is called the Gulf of Patras between mainland Greece and the Peloponnese. But it didn't extinguish the Ottoman military might. The Ottomans did rebuild their fleet, but they also maintained an extraordinary land army as well. And in the ensuing years, they make a foray eastward, the Ottomans do, into Persia. And students of history will remember that what's going on now in the 17th century is what we call the Thirty Years' War, which is a war among nation states, but it's also a war between Protestants and Catholics. Very involved and very, very bloody. I like to describe it this way. Europe was tearing at her own throat. And the Ottomans had an opportunity now to strike at their age-old enemy, Christian Europe, during the Thirty Years' War in the 17th century, but they did not, as I said, because they were distracted by campaigns in Persia, and also because they had a string of ineffectual sultans, if you will. But their fortunes changed, and a man named Mehmed IV took the throne, if you will, of the Ottoman Empire. And he made two very good decisions, he's famous for two decisions. One was an excellent one. He appointed a grand vizier, basically his number two, the guy that really ran the Ottoman Empire, a man named Kara Mustafa Pasha. And then he decided in the summer of 1682, Mustafa Pasha persuaded Mehmed IV to lay siege to Vienna. Vienna had been an age-old target of the Ottomans, and in fact, under Suleiman the Magnificent, prior to the Battle of Lepanto in the 1560s, he had made a foray to try to take Vienna unsuccessful.
Yeah, let's talk about why was Vienna particularly of interest to them?
Well, because it was the seat of the Holy Roman Emperor, I guess is kind of the short way to answer that question. It was a powerful political center of Europe. It was on the border with the Ottomans, where it sort of managed that area, especially as far as the Ottomans were concerned, where the Christian West and the Islamic East meet. And so it was a political rival, but it was a religious rival as well. It was the center of Central and Eastern European Catholicism. It's a short way to describe why. On the Danube, of course, it is a city of great tactical value as well, or strategic, we should even say. How's that for a quick explanation.
No, that's great. I think that provides a lot of context for why they would be intent on taking down Vienna.
Yes, yeah. So it's a fortress city. If you go to Vienna now, almost nothing of the walls is left. It's just kind of sprawling suburbs around the old downtown, or historic center, I guess we should say. But they do decide they're going to take it, and they send an army of hundreds of thousands, including, you know, the elite janissaries, on the long march towards Vienna. They leave in the spring of 1683, and then, like I say, they start pressing north towards Buda. They have barges going up the Danube towards Vienna, and when they eventually arrive, they set up set up their tents on the plains of Vienna surrounding the city walls, and they begin to invest the city, or, you know, as we say, they lay siege to the city.
And we're talking today with Christopher Check from Catholic Answers about the Battle of Vienna. We're painting the picture, or the backstory, of what led to this momentous battle. Take us to the next step now, Chris.
Sure. So the Holy Roman Emperor at the time is a man named Leopold I. It's obvious to him that Vienna is the Ottoman objective, and he permits himself to be. The occasion called for a man of sterner stuff, although he had managed the 30 Years' War. He permits himself to be talked into abandoning Vienna, but he leaves behind two truly heroic men, and I have to mention them, Michael, because they're sort of overshadowed by the giant figure in this story, whom we will come to. They are Count Ernst Rüdiger von Starhemberg, and he commands the garrison in Vienna, so the soldiers who stay within the city. And Charles VI, the Duke of Lorraine, takes the imperial army into the field, and it's really very small. I mean, about 10,000 cavalry. So the most he can do against an army of, probably about 150,000, 160,000 Ottomans is just sort of harass their lines and just kind of try to slow down their investment of the city. So what the Ottomans now are doing is they can't just up and over the walls. They begin the long process of breaching them. They're digging. It's sort of fascinating. It's fascinating to see maps of the period, but they're basically digging tunnels, kind of in zigzags, and trenches and tunnels and zigzags towards the wall so that they can continue to fight, remain covered. It's just siege warfare, classic siege warfare, and get close to what they locate the weakness in Vienna's walls between two bastions on the south side. Bastions, of course, are these, you know, giant mutually supporting towers, and that's where they concentrate their efforts. So the Viennese in the city are outnumbered badly. The difficulty getting resupplied, of course, because the city is surrounded. Siege warfare is every bit as much, you know, cannons as it is, you know, waiting people out. And then in the field you have Charles VI, Duke of Lorraine, just sort of harassing. But it's not something they're going to solve. They will eventually lose. Starhemberg realizes that eventually what is now tunnel warfare, trench warfare, siege warfare is going to become street to street, house to house, once those city walls are breached, and then that'll be the end. There'll be no way to they can stop an army of this size.
Now, the Holy Roman Emperor there in Vienna, what is he doing at this moment?
Leopold has left, and now you've caught me here. I'm not exactly sure where he's gone off to, somewhere off into the Austrian countryside. He's not really managing affairs. The guy who is Starhemberg and Sixth, but relief is coming in the form of the guy who overshadows everybody in this story, and with some good reason, because he's sort of a larger than life character. His name is John Sobieski, John the Third Sobieski, King of Poland. Poles love this guy, obviously. And he's like I say, he's a larger than life figure because he's a cavalryman, and his cavalry they're like the most just I don't know. I'm looking for the proper adjective. Flamboyant doesn't describe it, but over the top. Cavalry in the history of mounted soldiers. These guys are called the Winged Hussars, and they have wings. I mean, these giant feathered wings that they've mounted on the back of their saddles, and the effect in a cavalry charge is just sort of glorious and terrifying at the same time. So that comes later. Sobieski's on his way, but he's not the only one. George the Third of Saxony is coming from Dresden, and Maximilian the Second of Bavaria is coming from Munich. And all three of these forces unite near Krems, which is about 40 miles up river from Vienna, and then begins this difficult maneuvering of this largely cavalry force down through the Wienerwald, or what we today call the Vienna Woods. And if you go to Vienna today, you can really very much see what we're talking about here. It's a sort of a 30-mile long, 20-mile wide, thickly wooded foothills. There's ravines, there's walls, there's grapevines, there's hedges, there's brush. It's just very, very slow going down this ridge toward the plains of Vienna, where eventually they are going to arrive and rout the Ottomans. Before that, they gather at dawn on September 11th at a ruined church of the Camaldolites. You know, Camaldolites are old, very old hermits, and their mass is offered by Father Marco Di Viano. In fact, he's Blessed Marco Di Viano now. And then give their care. They commend their effort to the Blessed Virgin Mary. And then on September 12th, they begin their slow descent down the hill towards the plains of Vienna. And the Ottoman accounts are great. They describe it as a flood of black pitch flowing down the hill, smothering and incinerating everything that lay in its way.
So these are the Ottomans describing the Christian forces.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, the Ottoman accounts are great to read here. And so they get to the base of the hill, and they line up, and then the famous Winged Hussars that make the most famous cavalry charge I mean, there are others, you know. I suppose in the Crusades and in the taking of Sicily back from the Normans, but this has got to be the most famous cavalry charge in history, It just must be glorious to watch these guys with their outrageous wings, you know, streaming off the back of their steeds and just driving the Ottoman forces from the plains there. We came, we saw, God conquered, Sobieski wrote to Pope Innocent XI.
And we're talking today with Christopher Cech, president of Catholic Answers, about the Battle of Vienna. What was it that won the day in the end for the Christian forces?
Well, I mean, I'm happy to attribute it to the intercession of the Blessed Virgin Mary. We don't have a story like we do at Lepanto, where there's almost a universal account of the wind shifting in the favor of the Holy League. But they certainly did commend their effort to her intercession, and Vienna was saved. But we can also attribute it to Europe uniting to face down her age old enemy of the Islamic East, and to the skill and leadership of the three principles involved. Pope Innocent XI certainly recognized Mary's intervention, and he extended the Feast of the Holy Name of Mary to the universal calendar of the Roman Rite to grant the victory, to honor the great victory that Our Lady granted the Christian West. And
oh, great! I was going to ask you that. How was this battle commemorated or remembered, or what? How do popes and otherwise historians see this event?
Yeah, well, that's so September 12th is the Holy Name of Mary. The feast existed before the battle, but like I say, Pope Innocent extended it to the universal calendar. In 1969, when the calendar was reformed with the issue of the new missal of Paul VI, Pope St. Paul VI, I should say, the feast was removed from the universal calendar. But interestingly, in 2002, John Paul II restored the feast to the universal calendar. Now, there is no written record of this that I have seen, but I imagine that the trade tower attacks of the preceding year, you know, 2001 and a day before, might have been to the fore of Pope St. John Paul II's thoughts, but, you know, we don't know that.
Of course. We're talking today with Christopher Cech, president of Catholic Answers, about the incredible Battle of Vienna. I always like to ask you this when we have these conversations about war and the results of these wars. What would have happened if the battle had gone the other way?
You know, this is an interesting question. So for a time, certainly, Vienna would have fallen under Turkish rule. Turkey certainly had her allies on the western borders of Christian Europe, mostly with Protestants, almost exclusively with Protestants, periodically with the Orthodox, but in the main with Protestants. Earlier, just as an example, earlier in history, at the end of the 16th century, when Spain is fighting in the Netherlands, the Calvinists there, as a sign of solidarity with the Ottoman Empire, wear crescents on their berets. And Elizabeth II, also around this same time, in the late 16th century, so, you know, 70 years before this, 60 years before, enlisted the aid of the Turks in her wars against Philip II, King of Spain. So there were alliances between the Ottomans and Protestant Europe, and these would have been strengthened for a time. Whether or not the Turks could have held Vienna and that much of Europe over all this time seems a little unlikely to me, probably. Mm-hmm. But anyway, they probably would have held Vienna for a time. A lot of those churches would have been turned into mosques, but I suspect eventually would have faded. But please God, we don't have to worry about that. And you can still go to Vienna today and see the great churches there. Look for one thing, When you go to the cathedral, I'm surprised they haven't taken it down. When you go to the cathedral in Vienna, there is a on the exterior a statue of John Capistrano at the siege of Belgrade, and he's you know crushing a Turk underfoot. It's not exactly a woke statue, Michael. Well, I'm surprised they haven't taken it down, but go see it while you can.
Amazing. Well, we're so grateful to you, Christopher Check from Catholic Answers, for giving us these insights about the aftermath and all the details of war. These are incredible insights that you present in a very unique way, and we're so grateful for you joining us today. And I know with Catholic Answers, you have your annual conference coming up. Tell us a little bit as we wrap up what people need to know about that.
Sure. I believe in God is the theme. We're going back to the basics with this conference because of our age's principal affliction, which is widespread unbelief and getting more wide and spread. So I believe in God, CatholicAnswersConference.com. It's not this it's 2 weeks away. There's still tickets. Scott Hahn is coming, Frank Beckwith, Logan Gage, who runs the philosophy department at Franciscan, Dale Alquist, president of the American Chesterton Society, and then, of course, all the great Catholic Answers speakers are going to be there. It's really always a wonderful time. Come spend a long weekend in beautiful San Diego after all the tourists have gone home with a thousand of your fellow Catholic Answers friends. And then if you want something much smaller, Joe Heschmeyer, Cy Kellett, and I are taking a very small group of pilgrims. We're limiting it to 50 to Rome in November. CatholicAnswersPilgrimage.com to sign up for that. We stay in the Historic Center, and we see the city on foot, which is the way that Rome is meant to be seen.
Absolutely. Well, we're so grateful to you, Christopher Check, for joining us on today's program to talk about the Battle of Vienna. Thanks so much for being with us
today. God bless you, Michael.
God bless. That was Christopher Check, president of Catholic Answers. Check them out at Catholic.com for more information on that incredible work. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be looking at the question of the week. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. It's great to be back from South America and excited to be back behind the microphone this week. Special thanks to Father Edward Looney for stepping in last week for guest hosting the program. And each week I get all these emails around the world. People write in through the MiracleHunter.com website. And I love getting questions. Even when I give a talk, I travel around the country and I give approximately 20 talks a year to different parishes, conferences, and other institutions about miracles. And I love doing the question and answer afterwards. People have questions for 15, 20, or more minutes at the end. I'd like to hear what people are thinking about. And so we got a great email question from this week. It's a question from Cindy from Washington. She says, "Dear Miracle Hunter, I came across a short two-page article on St. Christina the Astonishing, and the brief information in the article certainly supports the astonishing of her life. But the item I noticed that she is a saint with an actual feast day, July 24th, but she has not been beatified. How can this be? Thank you, Cindy." Well, thanks, Cindy, for your question. It's a good one. And I think that there are various explanations why somebody wouldn't be beatified. And one of those types of things could be that if the person were canonized or beatified through equivalency, that would be from the Pope saying somebody is a blessed or a saint, even without all the miracles being there. And so that's happened various times throughout Christian history. I think St. Margaret of Castello was the most recent one who had that happen. But in the case of Christina, the Astonishing, yes, she is an official saint. Yes, she has an official feast day. But because she lived in the 1100s, she was pre-congregation in the sense that she came before the Congregation of Rites came to be by Pope Sixtus V in the year 1588 that established the process of beatification and canonization. Prior to that, perhaps it was a local bishop recognizing the martyrdom or the heroic virtues of a saint. Later, it was popes who did that, but there was no congregation or official process. So because her life happened before 1588, she wouldn't have that beatification that all modern saints do. And so that's just, she was an earlier saint than that was. So thanks so much, Cindy, for your question. And you can find out more about the canonization process and the various developments and changes over the centuries if you pick up my book, They Might Be Saints, which I profile 24 of the American Blesseds and Venerables. But in the first couple chapters, I talk about how miracles are investigated and how the Catholic Church has evolved over time, the sainthood process. So check that one out. They Might Be Saints, available from EWTNRC.com. Let's take a look at the 365 Days with Mary project. We do this every week where we look at the Marian devotion of the day. And there's, believe it or not, there's a different one for each and every day of the calendar year. You all know Fatima May 13th, or Lourdes February 11th, or Guadalupe December 12th. But believe it or not, there's a different other one for each and every day of the calendar year. So for today, September 9th, we have Santa Maria la Antigua, or Holy Mary the Ancient, from Panama City in Panama in the 16th century. And the story goes that when the founders of the town of La Guardia survived a confrontation with the natives in 1520, they fulfilled a promise to the Virgin Mary and later renamed the town Santa Maria la Antigua. A Christian community of native converts and Spaniards developed there around the chapel of St. Mary the Ancient, once the house of Chief Simaco, and the tiny chapel of St. Mary the Ancient became a cathedral under the Archdiocese of Sevilla when on September 9, 1513, Pope Leo X created the first mainline diocese with the bull Pastoralis Officii Debitum. In 2001, September 9th, it was established as her feast day of the Republic of Panama when the Vatican named St. Mary the Ancient as its patron. And that is Holy Mary the Ancient from Panama City in Panama. For more information on this fascinating Marian devotion or any of the hundreds of Marian devotions from around the world, you can connect to 365dayswithmary.com, go to the Facebook page 365 Days with Mary, download the app 365 Days with Mary, or go to the Facebook page and join any of the 10,000 followers of 365 Days with Mary. Let's take a look at They Might Be Saints. We do this every week where we talk about people on the path to sainthood. And this, of course, correlates with my television show, which airs on EWTN on Wednesdays. And also, it corresponds with my book, They Might Be Saints. We're talking about from miracle workers to martyrs to those ordinary people living extraordinary lives of heroic virtue. These are the people that make us wonder if someday they might be saints. And so we talk about the might be saint of the day. That would be a servant of God, a venerable, or a blessed who doesn't have all their miracles validated by Rome. And with one more, they will become a saint. So Blessed Jacques Desiré Laval, who was born on September 18th, 1803 in Normandy in France. He was a son of a prosperous farmer, and he grew up in a pious household with examples set by his mother and uncle, who was a priest. And Jacques' mother died when the boy was 7 years old, and he was initially torn between the priesthood and medicine. Jacques was educated at local schools and in France, and he received his medical degree in 1830. And Jacques established the medical practice in Saint-André and Saint-Ivry-la-Bataille in his native Normandy, and France became a worldly, ignoring spiritual things. And however, a near fatal fall from a horse led him to re-examine his life. A few months later, he closed his medical practice and he entered the seminary of Saint Sulpice, and he was ordained 4 years later in 1838. He became the parish priest in Normandy for 2 years, but Jacques felt a call to more active ministry and finally gave all his possessions to the Society of the Holy Heart of Mary, which later became the Congregation of the Holy Spirit and Immaculate Heart of Mary, and was sent as a missionary to Mauritius on September 14th, 1841, and he never saw France again. And he died on September 9th, 1864, in Port Louis, Mauritius, of natural causes. And he's buried at the Church of St. Croix, Port Louis, in Mauritius. And his tomb receives about 8,000 pilgrims a week and is known as the site of miracles. He was declared venerable by Pope Paul VI, and he was beatified by Pope John Paul II in 1979, April 29th. With one more miracle, Blessed Jacques Desiré Laval will be declared a saint. And that's the Might Be Saint of the Day, Blessed Jacques Desiree Laval for more information on this fascinating devotion to this saint, and also to any of the other 365 days of saints. You can go to They Might Be Saints, theymightbesaints.com. You can always check out my show. If you go to theymightbesaints.com, you can find out when the next episodes are airing, or you can just tune in next week, Wednesday, September 13th at 8 a.m. They Might Be Saints covers the life of Father Michael McGivney. This is one of my favorite episodes. Check this one out. These air each Wednesday on EWTN. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking to Maria Moreira Johnson, author of Our Lady of Charity, How a Cuban Devotion to Mary Helped Me Grow in Faith and Love. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. I just got back from South America, and I got to travel to some incredible places of Marian devotions in Brazil, the Aparecida Shrine there, and also in Argentina, Our Lady of Luján and Itati. These are all places where there was the uncovering or the finding of a miraculous statue. And as a result, popular devotion surrounded it, and a basilica or cathedral was built on the site, and popes have visited these places and shown their acknowledgement of the devotion. And the people who have these devotions, it's amazing to see the processions and the masses and the excitement that the local people have for the local patroness. And perhaps one of the most famous of all these cases of a miraculous statue being found, we talk about Nuestra Señora de Caridad del Cobre, Our Lady of Charity of Cobre in Cuba. And the feast day for that Marian devotion is September 8th. So it's a great time of year to reflect on Our Lady of Charity. And we're so excited to welcome back to the show Maria Moreira Johnson, author of Our Lady of Charity, How a Cuban Devotion to Mary Helped Me Grow in Faith and Love. Welcome back to the show today, Maria.
Thank you so much, Michael. It's always a pleasure to be here and talk to your listeners.
Yeah, it's great to have you on, and I think this is a big Marian devotion. It's the biggest of all in Cuba, and perhaps one of the biggest of all in Latin America. So I think it's an amazing, amazing devotion to reflect on. When you wrote the book, Our Lady of Charity, some years ago, what inspired you to put this together?
Well, first of all, I was born in Cuba, and so I grew up with that devotion. You know, when I think of Mary, I think maybe in the United States we think of images of Our Lady of Grace, for example, but the image that I always grew up with, the Blessed Mother, is Our Lady of Charity. And so, of course, she's my favorite. She's my mama.
That's right. And what is it about Our Lady of Charity growing up with that devotion? What did you think about Our Lady of Charity? What did you think about that devotion as somebody who had that image in your home, or there was this pre-existing devotion to her? As a young person growing up, what did you think of Our Lady of Charity?
Well, I always associate her with such a deep tenderness because, of course, it was my mother who introduced me to our mother in heaven, and so it has that sentimental value to it. But also, this is an image that I saw everywhere. When we traveled in Cuban and Cuban-American communities, you know, I visited Miami quite a bit, visited Union City quite a bit where my grandparents were. And so it was kind of neat to go into a restaurant and there's Our Lady of Charity painted on the wall or in a little, you know, chintzy little plastic statue by the cash register. And so when I think of Mary, that's the image that always comes to mind. But also the tenderness that I want to talk about is this unique representation that she has. You know, she holds, as so many images of the maternal Mary, holding the baby Jesus in her left hand and something in her right hand. In this particular case, Our Lady of Charity is holding not just the incarnation, but also the passion. She holds a cross in her right hand. And so when I look at that, I mean, it's the whole gospel right there.
Absolutely. We're talking today with Maria Moreira Johnson, author of Our Lady of Charity, How a Cuban Devotion to Mary Helped Me Grow in Faith and Love. And for those people who don't know the story, the original story that led to the finding of this statue and then the building of the basilica and the devotion that spread throughout all of Cuba, let's dial it back a bit. Tell us what is the actual seminal story of Our Lady of Charity?
So it's a story of how Mary comes to her children in times of strife, especially, you know, where there are abuses against the human person. We find Mary there. And so in 1612, on the eastern part of Cuba, where there was a copper mine that had been established by the Spaniards who had conquered Cuba, right? Had colonized Cuba, and it was also the intersection of the serfdom of the native Taínos who were in Cuba, as well as one of the important stopping points in the transatlantic African trade, slave trade. And so here you have this point where there is heavy abuses of humanity in the slavery and in the serfdom and the indentured servitude of the Native Americans there. And these three men, actually two men and a boy, two perhaps Taino, perhaps mixed race brothers, went to go gather some salt for curing of the meat to feed the people there. And they took along with them a 10-year-old African boy named Juan Moreno. And he's important to the story because in his 80s, he was able to recount the story in detail for church records. And so they went out in a canoe into the Bay of Nipe, and a storm came up. I'm editorializing here. Maybe it was a hurricane or a tropical storm. And they, they were terrified. And they had already been evangelized, and many of them were already baptized. And so in their fear, they turned to the Blessed Mother and asked for her intercession for safety. And the waters calmed, and lo and behold, there was a statue floating next to the canoe that was lashed to a board that said, Nuestra Señora de la Caridad, Our Lady of Charity. The unique thing about this statue is that it is clay, and it was sitting in the water, and it had not dissolved. On the contrary, it was dry. So these men took it as a sign that Mary had, in fact, interceded for them. And so they came back to set up their very first little shrine in thanksgiving to the Blessed Mother.
Wonderful. Thank you for recounting that that early origin story. And then how did the devotion grow beyond the finding of the statue? How did it become what it is today with a basilica there, papal visits, the entire island being dedicated to the patroness of Cuba?
Yes, absolutely. So this started with the working people, with the people who were oppressed. And so they kept it to themselves in a little shrine that they built made of palm fronds. And they would carry it with them. And eventually some church officials found out about that, and they thought, well, we need to bring this down to the copper mines and we need to take this down to our churches. All the little statue kept disappearing and going back down to the people. So what's unique about this particular devotion to Mary is that it really was a grassroots, as most devotions are, it was a grassroots thing for the people who needed Mary most at that time. And as travel and as trade continued, it made its way across the island to the other extreme where Havana is, and then that became a launching point into other places. And I don't think you know that I lived in Mobile, Alabama for some years. I just moved away right now this past month. And I am absolutely certain that devotion came to North America through the Mobile Bay, because that was one of the route spots for the slave trade. And so I'm certain that the slaves brought that devotion with them to this country. And I think that's unique. And I didn't know this the last time that I spoke with you. So this is something new that I can share.
That is amazing. We're talking today with Maria Moret Johnson about Our Lady of Charity, the famed Cuban devotion. And how meaningful was it to have the Pope visit Cuba and I believe he placed the statue of Our Lady of Charity on the altar when he said Mass, and to show that recognition of that devotion from the perspective of the Vatican? What was that like to have that devotion be honored in such a way?
Well, it's beautiful for two reasons. Number one, I was there. I actually got to travel to Cuba and be a witness to this. But three popes actually have gone to the Basilica, the National Basilica of Our Lady of Charity of El Cobre, and she's called El Cobre. She's from El Cobre, from the copper mine. Mm-hmm. And I think that it was St. John Paul II who took, what did he take for her? He brought her a gift. I think one of the popes, either Pope John Paul or it was Pope Benedict, took the Order of the Rose. I think that was, anyway, oh yes, it was. It was John Paul II crowned her. Pope Benedict took her the Order of the Rose. And then Pope Francis took her a beautiful silver urn filled with yellow flowers, which and white flowers, which are the colors of the Vatican, but her favorite color in Cuba is yellow. So a lot of people who like to bring gifts of flowers to Our Lady of Charity bring yellow flowers.
Wonderful. Well, that must have been an exciting thing to be there in person to see that papal visit. We're talking today with Maria Maria Johnson about Our Lady of Charity. And as we wrap up the interview today, Maria, talk a little bit about what your hope is for the book, Our Lady of Charity, How a Cuban Devotion to Mary Helped Me Grow in Faith and Love. What do you hope who the average person, perhaps who isn't even Cuban, who picks up this book, what will they learn, or where will their Marian devotion go as a result?
Oh, I think that it's an enriching devotion because, number one, because of what I stated earlier, that she really does have the incarnation and the passion there in the imagery. But also she's known for coming to her children when they are in storms, you know, and we have so many storms in our lives, whether they're personal, health, relationships, even broader in our culture, you know, these kinds of storms that come up unexpectedly, and we have recourse to the Blessed Mother to help guide us to safety. And so I think it's a beautiful story to share, and I think it's a devotion for anyone who is feeling that they're exiled in some way. You know, the Cuban exiles who left Cuba and came to the United States brought with them that devotion. And in Miami, there's another shrine, the Ermita de la Caridad, which is kind of a mini shrine for the Blessed Mother under this title. And so many people who feel exiled, you know, because of so much turmoil in the world, go there for recourse. So I think she's a beautiful, beautiful story to learn more about.
Wonderful. And for people who want to find out more about this book or find out more about you, what's the best place that people can go?
Well, you can find this book and my other books at AveMariaPress.com, or you can go and find them also on Amazon or my website, MariaMJohnson.com.
Wonderful. Well, we're so grateful to you, Maria Moreira Johnson, for joining us again to talk about Our Lady of Charity. Thanks so much for being with us on the program today.
You're welcome.
God bless. That was Maria Moreira Johnson. Check out her book, Our Lady of Charity, How a Cuban Devotion to Mary Helped Me Grow in Faith and Love, from Ave Maria Press. And that's all the time we have for today's show. If you missed any of this episode or want to catch up on past episodes, you can go to EWTN.com/radio, check out the audio archives, or download the free EWTN app. I'd like to thank our guest today, Christopher Check from Catholic Answers, talking to us about the Battle of Vienna, and Maria Moreira Johnson for talking to us about Our Lady of Charity. Check out the EWTN television series Explore the Miracle Hunter on Saturdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Tonight's program is about the devotion to Our Lady of Pompeii. And look out for my latest book, Science and the Miraculous, How the Catholic Church Investigates the Supernatural. It's out from Tan Books and available at EWTNRC.com. I'd like to thank you today for joining me on Miracle Hunter, where from claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth a hunt. Talk to you next week.